This podcast of To the Point is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support for KCRW podcasts comes from the Southern California Lexus dealers.
From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Is the U.S. winning the war in Iraq? Hello again, I'm Orman Olney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. President Bush said Tuesday night there's a clear plan for victory and that we are winning. He said the road of victory is the road that will take our troops home, but he did not say just what he meant by winning. Today's Washington Post editorializes that his actions do not match the rhetoric, and that if the troops come home too early, they will have lost. On To the Point, we'll get different views of what winning might look like, and whether the U.S. is moving in that direction. Also, with a kidnapped reporter still unaccounted for and a network anchor hospitalized by a roadside bomb, can reporters get the whole story? First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warman Olney, back with To the Point. President Bush says America is winning the war in Iraq, but he hasn't said just what winning means. On To the Point, we'll get several different opinions, with reporters facing deadly risks on a daily basis. We'll also ask, are American voters learning what they need to know? First, this news update. For the first time since Senate confirmation hearings last April, Intelligence Director John Negroponte appeared in public today at a hearing of the Senate Intelligence Committee. He gave what was called a unified assessment of threats that the U.S. is faced with. Jonathan Broder is Defense and Foreign Policy Editor of Congressional Quarterly, and it's always good to have you with us, Jonathan.
Hi, Warren.
Biggest threat, Al-Qaeda.
Yes, Al-Qaeda and the groups that are affiliated with it. This is consistent with the administration's continuing war on terror. They don't really see the Al-Qaeda threat going away anytime soon. Followed by, in terms of threat, the nuclear threats from Iran and North Korea.
He said, however, that he doesn't think Iran has a nuclear weapon as yet.
No, he didn't. But he said that there's an interesting sort of dichotomy here. On one hand, you had Negroponte in Washington at this hearing talking about Iran's nuclear programs as a cause for what he called immediate concern. And yet over in Vienna, where the International Atomic Agency, Atomic Energy Agency is meeting to discuss the Iran case, the head of the IAEA, Mohammed Bardi, made a point of saying that Iran's program is not an immediate threat.
So a little difference there, although El-Baradei is one who wants it referred to the United Nations Security Council.
Yes. What's happening right now with that is that the five permanent members of the UN Security Council, that's the United States, Russia, France, Britain, and China, have agreed separately as nations to refer Iran to the Security Council, but they're going to wait a month until the IAEA completes its report on Iran, which would be sometime in March. Right now, the governing board of the IAEA is meeting, and they're expected to vote tomorrow on whether that UN body is going to also recommend referring Iran to the Security Council.
Dr. Jonathan Broder at Congressional Quarterly. Let's get back to Mr. Negroponte's testimony. Again, it was a unified assessment. They used to get the CIA, the FBI, and the Defense Intelligence Agency all offering independent analysis, but this time it was Negroponte, at least on that subject, all by himself. Was this an opportunity for him to show that he's really in charge?
Well, I think that was the point. I mean, all the other intelligence chiefs were sitting alongside him. But the fact that Negroponte was the one to actually read this 24-page assessment, as you said, I think it showed that, you know, it's a new day now, that there's one person in charge of all of the 16 or 17 intelligence agencies, and that Negroponte is the point man on this.
This is To the Point from PRI. Again, we're talking with Jonathan Broder, Defense and Foreign Policy Editor for Congressional Quarterly. Well, Porter Goss, the director of the CIA, did in fact testify, and he had something to say about the disclosure of the warrantless wiretapping of American citizens. What was it?
Well, he called this, he said that the damage from these from this leak has been, he called it very severe to U.S. capabilities to carry out their mission. And he said that he used the words very severe intentionally, and he said that the evidence will show that. He didn't give any of that evidence, but I think that they were handed this question by a Republican on the committee, Kit Bond of Missouri, and they were very, very happy to get that question because there is tremendous concern within the administration about leaks, and the sense that we have here is that the administration, particularly the Justice Department, is going to pursue that particular leak very, very vigorously. So I would expect that the two New York Times reporters who broke that story might be receiving some sort of a subpoena to testify, and we'll have to see what happens then.
There also is a political context here because it appears that the president is getting a lot of support around the country for the warrantless wiretap on the ground that it helps to protect national security, even though those who are opposed to it say he could have been on much sounder ground legally if, in fact, he had gone to get warrants, and it wouldn't have been that hard to do.
It's a very interesting way that the administration is handling this. I mean, Bush has talked about this program, defending it every opportunity that he's gotten. He's also clearly sees it as a political winner. Karl Rove, the chief of staff at the White House, deputy chief of staff at the White House, has made it clear that the Republicans are going to run on the issue of national security once again in the midterm elections, and the polls show sort of a 50-50 split on this, but at least 50% of the population believes that the president is correct in believing that he has the power to conduct wiretaps without getting a court warrant, and that when it comes to elections, the American public will vote with him on that.
Jonathan Broder, as always, thanks a lot for being with us.
My pleasure.
Defense Foreign Policy Editor for Congressional Quarterly. On Reporter's Notebook later on, clean coal, is it still a dirty business as two more die in the mines of West Virginia? In a moment, is the U.S. winning the war in Iraq? On To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warman Alney back with To the Point. In his State of the Union message, President Bush declared that we are winning the war in Iraq. But the insurgency is still perpetrating its deadly attacks. Reconstruction is slow at best. An Iraqi government has yet to be formed, and there's concern that American troops will be brought home before stability has been established. Bill Arkin is a former soldier, military analyst for NBC, and a columnist for The Washington Post Online. Bill Arkin, always good to have you with us.
Thank you, Warren.
What would winning look like to you?
Well, I guess winning connotes a score, so I'm a little bit uncomfortable with that. The notion of winning, of course, could mean that we suppress the insurgency, defeat terrorism in Iraq, and thereby pave the way to get out. But I think in the Bush administration's new formulation, winning actually means training Iraqi police and security forces sufficiently so that U.S. forces can get out, regardless of whether or not the insurgency has been defeated and terrorism has been destroyed.
So has winning then, do you think, been redefined as the conflict has gone on?
Well, I think the Bush administration has clearly and wisely moved the goalposts. It is both naive to think that somehow terrorism can be defeated, quote-unquote, and I think also in Iraq, this is a highly fractured society with terrible gulfs between Sunni, Shia, and Kurd, as well as terrible gulfs just ethnically between the Kurds and the Arabs. And I think that it'll be very difficult to rule, and probably the United States is not going to be the country that's going to decide the future of the country, of Iraq.
You mentioned the war on terror. Do you think the president, by saying we are winning, was referring more broadly to the war on terror, or it seemed to me in the context of the speech that he was talking about Iraq?
Well, I thought he said Iraq as well, or at least certainly that was his focus. But even in the war on terrorism, I can't really fathom how the president could claim that we're winning. I don't say this, Warren, as a partisan opponent of the president. I say it because I see terrorism growing. I see the situation in Iraq being as bad as it's ever been. Roadside bombs, kidnappings, they seem to rear their head as soon as the military says that we're making progress somewhere. And worldwide, though Al-Qaeda, the organization that we knew on 9/11/2001, really no longer is that organization, terrorism has grown. Recruitment of terrorists certainly is successful in most parts of the Arab world. And I think, as I've said before, as a friend of mine in the military once said, you know, before 9/11, 100% of people in the Arab world hated us, and after 9/11, 105% hated us. So we made progress. And that's a problem with the war on terrorism, is that I don't see the measure, again, of winning, of being somehow that we are going to Wild West style kill terrorists one at a time and thereby somehow score a victory against them.
William Arkin, critic of the situation in Iraq, not, as he puts it, a partisan. However, let me introduce a person who's very much a supporter of the war in Iraq, was part of the New American Century Project, from which some of the Paul Wolfowitz and others also came, people who were involved with the early policy planning of the invasion. Tom Donnelly is now resident fellow in defense and security policy studies at the American Enterprise Institute. That's, of course, a conservative organization. He's also author of their National Security Outlook. And Tom Donnelly, good to have you back on our program.
Thanks, Warren. You're giving me far too much credit for the administration's actions, and I don't deserve it.
Modest comment, and we'll...
I also don't want it either.
we'll take it. The question is, what do you think? Are we winning?
Well, look, I would agree with a lot of what Bill has said, except there are two places I would differ. First of all, I do, you know, winning is so much in the eye of the beholder, and it is almost an entirely empty term in this, because even if you think we're winning, which I, you know, if I'm forced to, I say yes, we're winning. The war is so long, and sort of figuring out where you are on that long road. Both in Iraq and in the larger long war, as the Pentagon is now calling it, it is really quite difficult. But certainly I would say one of the measures of victory is not so much Americans coming home as making it safe for Americans to stay. I think that our military commitment there, I mean in Iraq and more broadly in the region, is really likely to, you know, continue indefinitely and be large scale as well. And if we're not willing to do that, then I think that's a metric of defeat, not of victory.
Well, what about what Bill Arkin said a moment ago, quoting a military a friend of his, that 100% of the people in the Middle East hated us before, now it's 105%. If that's the case, if making it safe for Americans in Iraq is the definition of winning, how are we doing?
We're going along. I mean, we don't honestly really know exactly precisely how we're doing. This has, you know, been the complaint going back for a couple of years now, back to Don Rumsfeld's famous metrics memo, and quantifying a war of this character is bound to be frustrating and I think misleading. The signs of progress are measured in the building of a new Iraqi government. And as you rightly said, we're in one of those pauses wherein the Iraqis kind of disappear behind the closed doors. And we don't really know precisely what's going to come out. I mean, this is as much something we have to take on faith and continue to just kind of put our heads down and hope that it works out for the best. But we also at this point have a 3-year history of not simply frustration and failure, but also of you know, creating a new set of political conditions in Iraq, which I think are really the only hope for both Iraq and more broadly for the region.
Bill,
it's very difficult to go backwards.
Bill Arkin said earlier that the definition of winning, the goals in Iraq, have in fact been modified as time has gone on. Douglas Faith, Paul Wolfowitz, people involved in the Project for a New American Century, which you were before as well, have now left the Pentagon. Is that where the change has come? And do you think that that victory may be redefined in such a way that it will ultimately mean bringing the troops home? And if so, will that be a victory or a loss?
Well, to begin with the last question, I really do think that a military withdrawal would be unwise and would be a confession of failure. Even if we do eventually end up in that position, I just think that would be a catastrophe of the highest order. And those who continue to hold out, as way too many in the administration do, the prospect of significant troop withdrawals, I think, are undercutting the president's strategy and is a self-defeating, attitude to take.
Okay. Tom Donnelly, once again, now at the American Enterprise Institute. A lot of people are saying, of course, that one of the things that the Republicans, at least, would like to see happen is for troops to start coming home before the elections in November. We'll try to get back to that question with Tom Donnelly and Bill Arkin in a moment. First, though, I want to introduce a third guest, Paul Pillar, who's a former CIA National Intelligence Officer for the Middle East, now visiting professor at Georgetown University Center for Peace and Security Studies. And, Professor, thank you for joining us.
Good to be with you.
You think we're winning?
I think it's a mistake to talk about, you know, winning or losing. Those are just terribly oversimplifying terms, although they're understandably used in the rhetoric. You look at Iraq, and there are so many things that are metrics, whether it's on the security side, numbers of casualties, numbers of incidents, numbers of Iraqis trained, or on the economic reconstruction side, whether it's how much electricity being produced or what have you. You can choose your measures, and ultimately it comes down to methodology, whether you want to focus on the ones that are going up or the ones that are going down. And that doesn't even talk about the non-measurable ones, which I think at the current state of affairs are at least as important. I'm referring specifically to the politics that the Iraqis are engaging in right now as they try to construct a new government. There is an awful lot of important politicking that's going to go on over these next 2 or 3 months, and whether it arrives at a new Iraqi government that is much more inclusive than what we were seeing last year, in which the Sunni Arabs were largely excluded, will go a long way toward determining, you know, what kind of conversation we would have on this subject a year from now.
What about reconstruction?
Well, again, you've got ups and downs. Some of the most basic things, infrastructure, electricity, we still seem to be stuck around, you know, 4,000 megawatts a day in production, in generation, which is less than the 4,400 or so that was averaged before the war and well below the 6,000 that was the goal when we went in. That's very important. You know, Baghdad, they have fewer hours of in which the juice is on than was true before the war, although there are other areas in the country where the opposite was true. Saddam Hussein tended to favor Baghdad in rationing his electricity. So again, it's a matter of choose your measure, or even within one measure like electricity, which part of the country you're talking about.
Again, Paul Pillar is former CIA National Intelligence Officer for the Middle East, now visiting professor at Georgetown University's Center for Peace and Security Studies. This is To the Point from PRI. Bill Arkin, back to you, military affairs analyst for NBC. Does the military know really what degree of success it is having in Iraq?
Well, as Paul Pillar said, there are metrics, how many soldiers are dying, the degree to which you're making the roads safer for the delivery of goods and services throughout the country. So they do know. On a sort of tactical level, on a small scale level, how they're doing, but I don't think that if they're doing well, that either they're conveying that very well to the American public or necessarily even to the experts. I look at Iraq and sort of say to myself sometimes, I'm way too far away to really gauge what our strategy is and how we're doing in that military strategy, and I feel like the military officers who are there on the ground are way too close, and that they see it very tactically, and they don't have a big picture. But what is very clear is that the administration has found itself in a bind of, on the one hand, being committed to the long-term conditions in Iraq, and the president particularly being committed to the development of a democracy in that country, while on the other hand trying to respond to the growing American discomfort with the war and the desire on the part of many, including, I would say, the uniformed military, to get out of Iraq. And that's a factor here, which is one that we don't often see very clearly, and that is that the military itself, I think, would prefer to get out. And I think that that's to some degree behind the fervor with which they are trying to train Iraqi troops and Iraqi police today, because that's going to be the trade-off between their ability to stay or not.
Let me go back to Paul Pillar again, formerly with the CIA. Do you think the military wants out?
Oh, I wouldn't claim to speak for the military, but I would second something Bill Larkin said, that many of the more optimistic observations one hears from our military in Iraq, I think, are quite honest ones. They are not contrived or being forced on the officers or enlisted people who express them, but it does reflect being a little bit too close to the situation. That is to say, tactically in this province or this town, successes are scored. Our forces are rightfully proud of that, but that really doesn't give you the bigger picture, which includes the politics, the popular attitudes, and all the other things we've just been discussing.
Okay, you can be too close, you can be too far away as well. Tom Donnelly, back to you. Paul Pillar said a moment ago that talking about winning and losing is oversimplified. You said that you think that the talk about getting the troops out is undermining the president. But what about the president himself using a term like winning and making that a declaration? What do you think? Did he undermine his own case in any way by doing that?
I don't think his talk of winning undermines his own position. I do think the policy of, the president is obviously committed to victory and success, whatever exactly that may mean in Iraq. And his, one of the things that keeps the policy from collapsing entirely is the president's enthusiasm and obvious, personal commitment to the mission. But things begin to unravel the farther one gets away from the Oval Office. And I think Bill was quite right that the professional military, and particularly the senior officers, are deeply worried about the ability, particularly of the Army and the Marine Corps, to sustain this level of effort over an extended period of time. So what undercuts the president's personal commitment and his moral commitment is the means with which the military has to execute that mission.
Okay, Tom Donnelly, once again with the American Enterprise Institute. Thanks to you. Thanks to Paul Pillar, formerly with the CIA, Bill Larkin, a military affairs analyst for NBC. After a brief break, we'll talk with reporters about the deadly risks for journalists in Iraq. On Reporter's Notebook later, after two more deaths in the mines of West Virginia, we'll talk about clean coal. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from the Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
Warman Ani back with To the Point. Jill Carroll, the freelancer on assignment to the Christian Science Monitor, is still missing after her kidnapping almost a month ago. More than 30 journalists are known to have been abducted, and at least 60 have been killed. Many more have been injured, including, of course, Bob Woodruff, the ABC anchorman who's been hospitalized by a roadside bomb. All of these people, in addition to the problems that they have suffered, have staff people who have been injured and killed in many instances as well. Alyssa Rubin is co-bureau chief in Baghdad for the Los Angeles Times. And Alyssa, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. Actually, I'm not in Baghdad now. I'm back in Vienna, but I was just there.
Okay. And are you going back?
Well, not imminently, that's for sure.
Okay. Well, we want to talk to you about the very remarkable piece you wrote about what it's like to be in a war zone, in this particular war zone, and to be assigned to go do a story with all that that requires, including translators and security people and all the rest. And you wrote about an incident where the risk just seemed too great and you had to turn around. Tell us about it.
Well, I have traveled quite a lot outside of Baghdad in the course of my about 2.5 to plus years in Iraq, and it seemed a very natural thing to do. But after Jill Carroll's kidnapping, and with a sort of sense that there are just very, very few of us who do not look, who look white essentially, and can be picked out, I felt quite nervous. And I went anyway. I began a trip, but I got to a point where I had to make a choice about whether to actually leave Baghdad, and I could not have come back to Baghdad. I would have had to spend the night outside of the city, probably in a home, where it would be very easy for people to find out I was there and either follow me coming back or even try to do something to the people I would be staying with, number one. And number two, if I did try to come back, I would have to walk across a bridge where I would be quite visible. Now, like Jill Carroll, I traveled, you know, wearing an abaya and a hijab, and I might not be picked out right away, but there'd certainly be a risk for me and for everyone with me, my translator, my drivers would probably have to have left their cars. This was a special new security measure that they were stopping traffic into Baghdad for 48 hours, partly to try to I think, halt some of the suicide bombs and that sort of thing. And so they would have had to stay outside of Baghdad, outdoors with their cars. That would have put them at risk. And I just felt I couldn't do that, both for myself, but also for everyone else involved.
When you had to make that decision, what was the ultimate cost to the journalism? What did the readers of the Los Angeles Times not learn that they might have learned otherwise?
Well, it was a profile I was working on of a young woman who's quite remarkable and has been involved in politics and then sort of been pressured into leaving politics. And while I will be able to tell her story without that particular trip, it will not be as vivid. It will not have as much immediate information from just last week when I was there. Now, I've spoken to her on the phone, and I have gone down for a short visit, but I wasn't able to do the kind of longer, you know, sort of spending a day with her family, which I had hoped to do, and seeing her interact in that environment. You lose a little bit of Iraq. You lose a little bit of who the Iraqis are, and they're much more than just people lamenting suicide bombs, understandably, or people in politics, or police who are beleaguered as they're under attack.
Alyssa Rubin, once again, is co-bureau chief in Baghdad for the Los Angeles Times. We'll come back and talk further with her. Johanna Magiri, a senior foreign correspondent for Time magazine. And Johanna, welcome to you.
Thank you.
You have written, since you got back from Iraq, a report for the Century Foundation about how it's going in terms of the reportage of the war, and you say that you and pretty much everybody else you know who's in the same position is very frustrated over how the story of the Iraq war is being told. Elaborate a little bit on that, starting out with the risks that we heard about from Alyssa Rubin, but then you have many other concerns as well.
Well, I think Alyssa is right when she says that the difficulties of going outside of Baghdad are one of the huge constraints on all reporters who were there. And what happens in the end is that you feel that there are huge swaths of the story that you just cannot adequately see and feel for yourself. You can send out local stringers, you can get reports in, but you can't do what reporters are really used to doing, that is being there and spending all that time there yourself and not being the center of the story, but listening to other people talk and not having to spend all your time worrying about, am I safe? Are the people with me safe? So I think that I certainly felt, and I think a lot of my colleagues do too, that we're getting the tip of the iceberg. You know, we try really hard. Everybody does some really good stories, but there's so much out there that we just can't go and see. And that's not the way to cover a story as big and complicated as the story in Iraq.
You list in your report to the Century Foundation some very important subjects, the facts about Shiite power, for example, the strength of Iraq's factional militias. How important are those to assessing? We began this program with the president's statement about we are winning the war in Iraq. How important are those subjects to try to figure out if we're winning or not?
Well, they're utterly crucial. I mean, you know, when the president makes a pronouncement like that, he is acting on the basis of what the U.S. military and U.S. intelligence tell him. Well, their information, in a lot of ways, isn't any better than ours is. I don't know that a lot of Americans, whether they're armed or unarmed, have spent a lot of time in those communities in the southern part of the country where the Shiites have been essentially running the place since the fall of Saddam. And I think there's a lot about how they're doing it and who's doing it and what the results of their doing it are that have a crucial impact on the war. Are these people, you know, are they going to separate from the rest of the country if they don't get their way, or aren't they? We don't know the answers, really, to so many key questions like that.
What about these factional militias?
Well, ditto for them. I mean, you know, the Shiite alliance that came in first in the last election, most of the groups that make up that alliance have had in the past their own militias. Those militias haven't completely gone away, but we don't know exactly where they are, exactly what they're doing. Are they just laying low, waiting to come to the fore if things don't go their way, or aren't they? Are they depoliticized? Are they disarming? Or are they armies in waiting? I mean, these are the kinds of questions that need to be answered over and over again as the situation changes. And we just don't have very good ways of doing that.
Johanna McGeary, once again, senior foreign correspondent for Time magazine. Back to Alyssa Rubin with the Los Angeles Times. Another thing that Johanna mentions is getting beyond the statistics handed out by U.S. and Iraqi officials. How strongly do the officials in charge try to spin the story?
Well, I think that exactly the problem China is talking about is very real. We don't know. I mean, if you can't go and see things for yourself, or if, as in the case of Bob Woodruff, he did try, but it was too dangerous, you aren't able really to make that assessment. We certainly know that some things are either inflated or perhaps wishful. Not inflated so much as I think wishful. I mean, often when the U.S. reports how many people it may have killed, you know, they'll fire into an area where they have received fire from, and they will say, you know, there were 10 or 20 or 50 insurgents killed. And I don't think in many cases that they've actually done a body count and looked at how many people there are dead on the ground. They have some sense of how many are there, and they make a good estimate based on a lot of information and intelligence, but it's not fully accurate, and it doesn't give a complete picture. And I think that goes for, it's not even spin, it's just the realities of covering war. I mean, it may be spin, but it's often, I think, just the really the vagaries of what happens when there's an awful lot of fire in several different directions, and you can't go and check. You can't even sometimes go to the hospital because it's in an area that's too difficult for a Westerner to travel in.
Johanna McGeary with Time, back to you. You also talk about the truth about the insurgency and whatever relation there might be and whatever negotiations there might be between American forces or even the current Iraqi forces and the insurgents. That's another thing you can't get at?
Well, the hardest part of the story, of course, is to get inside the insurgency. We at Time have had some reporters who have been quite bold in penetrating some of the insurgent networks, but that's an incredibly dangerous thing to do. And in the end, you have no idea how accurate the information is that you collect there. This is a place where it is very, very hard to gauge the credibility of the people you talk to, because everybody has an axe to grind, and we're picking up things, bits and pieces, a little bit piecemeal. You get a snatch here, a snatch there. It's really, really hard to add it up to a coherent picture. And when you couple that with the reluctance on the part of, I think, officialdom, both U.S. and Iraqi officials, to really tell you what's going on, the picture is extremely hard to feel confident in.
So, Alyssa Rubin with the L.A. Times, what can you say then to people in this country who are trying to figure out what's going on, who want to assess what the president said, that we are winning in Iraq? How can they judge a statement like that?
Well, I think you do have to read as much as you can, and you get some general sense of parts of the picture, but you just have to constantly be skeptical about what anybody tells you, positive or negative. There are parts of Iraq that are quite quiet, and those don't get written about either. Now, maybe they're quiet at a price, as Jahan was saying. There are militias, and they are running certain cities or running even whole provinces. Sometimes there are a couple or three militias that have divided the responsibility. But some of those places are relatively safe. So if you were living there, you might feel quite secure, in contrast to Baghdad, where most people feel very insecure. So I think the best thing you can do if you want to try to get a picture is read not just American sources, but look at some of the look at the European papers and look at the Arab, what's in the Arabic media, some of which is now translated into English on the web, and you get a sort of a puzzle, but you will get some picture, but it will not be complete. It can't be.
Johanna McGeary, what do you say to the people, and we hear them on this program, I'm sure everybody does, who is engaged in trying to do journalism about this story, who say, we only report the negative, we never report the good news about what's going on in Iraq, because reporters are liberal, they don't like the war, and they're effectively against it?
Well, I have to say that I think that's baloney. We report everything that we can get to, see, find out about, and that includes good things that are happening as well as negative things that are happening. But to be quite honest, it's pretty hard to go and find the good things that are happening because it's really dangerous to do that. I mean, it's not just dangerous to go into a shooting situation. It can be dangerous to try to go to a school and talk to people. The Italian journalist who was kidnapped at the university. It's not that we don't want to find out about these things. It's that we are incredibly constrained from doing that. And that's the thing I think that no American who's just sitting at home can possibly imagine. They don't know what it's like to be in jeopardy at all times, no matter what you're trying to find out. So it isn't a willful thing. It's really a matter of the incredible difficulty and the intense danger that people are in. They tend to color, we report what we can, but we all know that it isn't everything that's out there. That's for sure.
Has there ever been a particular incident that illustrated for you the greatest moment of risk? Or, Johanna McGeary, as you were saying a moment ago, do you just feel you're at risk all the time?
I think most of us feel that we're at risk all the time, but we do a lot of things to minimize that risk and to understand, which circumstances are you willing to put yourself on the line for and which ones you're not. And Alyssa talked about that, about a moment when I should not go there because that's beyond the limit of the kind of reasonable risk a person would take. And you have to judge that every day about everything that you do. Because it's not always obvious. Jill Carroll was kidnapped when she had an appointment to see somebody whose own security people would have protected her. So that would seem like a reasonable risk, and it turned out that it wasn't. So you have to make that judgment every day. And I think in the end what exhausts reporters and what makes everybody say, okay, I've been there too long or I'm not going back, is that your judgment of those risks becomes fallible, and you can't put yourself through that, and you definitely can't put the people who work for you through that all the time because you're the one who's jeopardizing them.
Alyssa Rubin, you're now in Vienna covering the IAEA meeting. You said you're uncertain as to whether you were going back or not. Is it your choice? And are you having trouble determining? Do you have the sense that maybe you've done it enough?
I certainly feel that way. I sort of made that decision a while ago, and then had a relapse desire to go back to Iraq, and the editors accommodated me. But I think you definitely do a certain amount of time, and you need a really long break from it, because that kind of decision making is enormously stressful. You really feel that it's, I mean, not just your life and your family's happiness and sort of feelings that are at stake, but also a lot of the people you work with who make it all possible, and you just don't want to put them at risk at a certain point, and you can't even, it gets harder and harder to make those decisions in a sensible way journalistically.
Well, thank you both for the extraordinary risk that you've taken for representing journalists in Iraq so articulately, so candidly, and so very effectively. We're just delighted to have both of you with us. Alyssa Rubin with the Los Angeles Times, Johanna McGeary with Time Magazine. Again, thanks to both of you.
You're welcome.
This is To the Point from PRI. In the State of the Union address, President Bush talked about clean coal as part of America's energy future. Yesterday, two coal miners were killed in West Virginia, where 14 others have died in just the past few weeks. More in a moment on To the Point.
You can find more information on the program, including archived editions, at www.moretothepoint.com. More to the point, all one word, .com.
Norman Olney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. At coal mines across West Virginia today, miners started their shifts with lectures on safety, and state officials began a round of inspections. After the recent deaths of 16 miners, coal operators say they're complying with what the Bush administration is calling a stand down for safety. Jeff Goodell writes for Rolling Stone magazine. His upcoming book is called Big Coal: The Dirty Secret Behind America's Energy Future. Jeff Goodell, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You wrote in the New York Times that one of the toughest turnaround jobs in American industry has been to change the perception of coal from an industrial relic of the 19th century to an energy source for the 21st century. What are examples of some of the ways that they've tried to change the perception?
Well, the coal industry's run a well-funded and quite extensive campaign for clean coal, trying to suggest that they've basically solved all of the environmental problems and other problems that go along with burning coal that we're all so familiar with. They really want to sort of rinse the image of the dirty smokestack from the public's imagination and position coal as the default fossil fuel for the 21st century.
You describe in your piece a ad featuring, as you describe them, glamorous, scantily clad models, male and female, shoveling coal in a dark mine. Is coal mining anything like that?
No, I think that I'm sure that GE is not going to be running that ad anytime soon. I mean, one of the things that this whole turnaround campaign for coal has been trying to do is really make us forget what really goes on in a coal mine, and that's one of the things that we've been reminded of in these with these deaths of these 16 coal miners. I mean, you have right now, coal is booming. The price of coal has skyrocketed, and you have a lot of coal operators opening up what had previously been considered marginal mines. And when you combine that with regulatory rollbacks under the Bush administration, it's a recipe for trouble.
You talk about a coal miner who was spending 8 hours a day in a coal seam in western Kentucky that was 20 inches high, mining while lying on his belly. How much of that kind of thing is going on?
Well, one of the things that's not talked about a lot in this story about these coal miners is that all the easy coal in Appalachia is gone. They've been mining coal in Appalachia for close to 150 years. And naturally, they went after the easy-to-get coal first. The coal that's left is increasingly difficult to access in seams that are increasingly narrow. And in some cases, this kind of mining can be done safely with better technology. And in some places, it can't. And you're seeing right now a lot of mines opening because the coal prices are so high, they want to make a buck. And so they're going after this this difficult-to-get coal. And, you know, a 20-inch seam is, you know, hardly enough to lay down in. But when you're getting, you know, upwards of $100 a ton for it, it's worth it.
Is it possible to do that safely?
Well, yes, it is. I mean, I think that, you know, coal miners will tell you that it's not so much the the sort of heights of the mine when you're under there. It's the other conditions, the geologic conditions of the roof, the amount of water that there's always a lot of water in coal mines, or often a lot of water, and of course the explosive gases. So the thickness of the coal seam itself is not necessarily an indicator of danger, although it's certainly more uncomfortable for the miners.
You mentioned deregulation by the Bush administration. What do you mean?
Well, the Bush administration has done broad regulatory rollbacks, not just towards mine safety, but for the coal industry in general, allowing changing rules to allow dirty coal plants to keep operating, changing rules to allow mountaintop removal mining that's the sort of devastating mountain where they flatten mountains in West Virginia and Kentucky, changing rules to make that easier, cutting back the number of mine inspectors, changing the point of view of the Mine Health and Safety Administration from enforcement to compliance assistance, they call it. It's been a broad campaign to basically make it easier for the coal industry to get the coal out of the ground.
Senator Byrd from West Virginia, a Democrat who has been representing that state for decades, is calling for new regulations. What's his history and that of politicians in general in West Virginia regarding this industry?
Well, I mean, West Virginia is basically a state that's been sort of owned and operated by the coal industry for a long time. I mean, that sounds blunt, but it's true. Senator Byrd has been, of course, very articulate, very powerful, principled man, but in his long history has been a powerful advocate for the coal industry. But, you know, he's also an intelligent man, and some of his comments today and yesterday show that he understands very clearly that this comeback of coal that the industry is so hoping for is not going to happen if it means that we're going to be witnessing, you know, the funerals of miners.
Jeff Goodell, again, contributing editor at Rolling Stone magazine. Well, West Virginia, though, is only the second highest producing state. The highest is Wyoming. Is the situation in Wyoming, where they haven't been mining coal for 150 years, very different?
It's entirely different. It's practically not even the same substance that they're mining. And in Wyoming, practically all of the mines are large surface mines that have coal seams that can be up to 80 feet thick. And in some places, it's so simple as sort of basically digging it out with a spoon. I mean, it's really an entirely different thing. And the rise of the Wyoming coal market, the coal mines, has been devastating for West Virginia and has actually put more pressure on them to go after some of this hard-to-get coal. The problem with Wyoming coal is that it is of a lower heat value, so you have to burn more of it, so it means more carbon dioxide emissions. And the other big problem is that it's a long way away, so you've got to haul it on trains, and the railroads are operating at maximum capacity as it is, and they just can't get any more of it out of there.
In West Virginia, in Pennsylvania, the other traditional coal mining states, you have described the culture around coal mining, and it's kind of a red state to culture, as you describe it. Tell us a little bit more about that and the willingness of people to take the risks, the kind of fatality that they have, or fatalism, I should say, about the industry and what it means.
Well, one of the things that you find when you spend a lot of time in coal mining states, especially in Appalachia, is this is in the blood of a lot of people there. They have been mining. Some of the coal miners there that I've talked with and been in mines with are third, fourth, fifth generation coal miners. And a lot of them really love what they do. And it's hard to understand if you've never been in a mine, but it's, to a lot of people, quite enjoyable work. It's underground. It's a kind of secret brotherhood under there. There's a tremendous sense of camaraderie. One miner described it as wrestling with nature down there. They really love it. But the problem is that because of the decline, partly because of the decline of the mining unions, which the mining industry itself has gone out of their way to break and to get out of there, it's a difficult situation for these miners, because when they run into dangerous situations, it's very hard for them to say, no, I'm not going in there, because the coal operators will just say, well, fine, go work at Walmart stocking yo-yos. And if you have a family to support, and that means, you know, taking a pay cut of half as much money, that's very difficult. So you have a lot of these miners going into what they know are dangerous mines because they have a family to feed and because they have a strange love for this work.
What kind of money did they make?
Well, the National Mining Association will tell you that a coal miner, average coal mining salary is $50,000 a year. That is true, perhaps, if you average it out over the entire industry and include big equipment operators and stuff. In the most dangerous mines, which are the small independent operators in Appalachia, the average pay is maybe even half that, $13, $14 an hour, $25,000 or $30,000 a year. It's nowhere near as good as the industry would like you to believe it is.
So what about the future? You said that coal's big right now, it's cheap, it's accessible, new mines are opening up, even in places where it's very difficult to get the coal out. Is clean coal going to be a part of our energy future? Does that seem inevitable?
Well, it does seem inevitable. I mean, there's tremendous reserves of coal in America. The price of natural gas and the price of oil are going to sort of demand that we burn coal. But I do think that, you know, we're as a society going to have to make some decisions about, you know, what we want to really pay for cheap energy. I mean, coal is cheap energy, but it also is dead miners, air pollution, asthma, and most significantly of all, it's the number one source of carbon dioxide emissions, which means that if we are going to get a handle on global warming, we have to figure out a way to get a handle on coal.
Jeff Goodell, his book, Big Coal, The Dirty Secret Behind America's Energy Future. Thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you.
Today's program produced by Jonah King with Karen Radziner and Katie Cooper, Technical Director Mike Newport. You can listen online anytime at moretothepoint.com. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.
You've been listening to KCRW's To the Point. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including Left, Right, and Center, our provocative, up-to-the-minute, witty confrontation over politics, policy, and popular culture, with Matt Miller, Robert Scheer, Tony Blankley, and Arianna Huffington. Check out the podcast of Left, Right, and Center at kcrw.com.